Hello, everyone. Welcome to another edition of the Bharat Vartha Weekly. I have with me your guests, Ashish Chandorkar and Srivatsa Subarna, here to discuss the news and events of the week that was. Hi, Ashish. Hi, Vatsa. How are you guys doing?
Hi, Kari. Doing good.
Hey, Kari.
So, last week was a super busy week for us. We put out four really nice episodes, starting with the one with Ruchir and Vishal, which again was a sort of a continuation of the India and the Foreign Press episode that we did. And here, I mean, we really spoke about, you know, what India's civilizational narrative can be and what we should talk about and promote in the world, right? So, again, we went into a huge amount of depth on that front. It was a 90-plus minute podcast. We covered some of the topical issues that obviously we have seen over the last 2-3 weeks, including, you know, some of the celebrities tweeting against the farmer protests and stuff like that, right? Tweeting in support of the farmers protests and stuff like that. Ashish, what did you think about the Long India episode we did with Radhika Gupta?
Yeah, pretty interesting episode. Radhika is one of the pioneers in this field in terms of introducing new products. She's the MD and CEO of Edelweiss Mutual Funds. And she had a pretty good refreshing perspective on investing itself and also why she's optimistic about Indian future. So very interesting discussion. Really liked it.
What's up? Did you catch the Guy Solomon episode?
Yeah. It was a great episode. I mean, to have someone of that stature on our podcast, he's written like 20-30 books and is known as one of the foremost thinkers on modern capitalism. And it was very refreshing to see, hear his views on India and, you know, his appreciation of the book written by Harsh and Rajiv.
Yeah, and of course, we had the Bharat Vartha Sports, which is a fortnightly feature that we do, where we discuss the India-England series. Moving on, last week, China released images of the Galwan clash and acknowledged 4 casualties. They released the video on social media while accusing the Indian army of being quote-unquote aggressive. A total of 20 Indian jawans were martyred in the clashes at Galwan Valley in June last year. The announcement comes before the 10th round of talks between military commanders of India and China, which is scheduled to be held on Saturday. These talks will reportedly discuss disengagement at other friction points like Hot Springs, Gogra, Depsang Plains, and so on. Ashish, what is the strategic significance of this?
See, the clash in Galwan happened in May of last year. Right? So there has been a buildup since then. I mean, in the Pangong So area, as well as in Galwan since May in that region. And India, of course, was... we accepted what happened in the events of June. We released the names of the martyrs on our side. But China had never acknowledged that despite several rumors and pictures kind of coming out. So I think just now, after like 9 months of the first build-up in the region, and the fact that the disengagement is now over in the Pangong So area where the Chinese have gone back from Finger 4 to Finger 8 area, and India has given up on the heights that we had occupied on the southern bank of the lake. It probably, if you look at the pictures which Indian Army released, the Chinese Army was seen marching in a hurry along with their equipment as if they did not want to stay there. In fact, in the last round of the Corps Commander meeting, The Chinese side has reported to have said that they were mentally and physically tired. So I think the whole narrative around the pictures and the videos which came out from the disengagement shows that China was the aggressor. They are pushing back on their side. And the fact that they have to retreat. And this was probably more like a tactical loss of face for the Chinese. I mean, they're not used to compromising on their positions or their approach to various borders. Another example would be in South China Sea, where they have been the aggressors and they have not accepted it. So I think the whole narrative was kind of stacked against them in terms of how the pictures looked and how the videos looked. So they released their side of the story on the Galwan Valley clash, which happened in June. And there they basically I mean, they are saying that four of their soldiers have been decorated. They don't say how many have been martyred. I mean, you know, it could be the number could be 40 or it could be four. So they really haven't eased that. But what they said in a very tactical way was that four have been decorated, and they did a full ceremony for that, etc. So it's a little bit of a shame for the Chinese soldiers who may have lost their lives. I mean, the initial numbers pegged was like 35 to 43 was the range that people were talking about in that times. And the fact that India outmaneuvered them tactically in August by occupying the southern heights on the Pangong. So I think that has probably left them a little flabbergasted. Having said that, Chinese retreat doesn't mean much. They could spring another surprise elsewhere. I mean, that's typically been the military strategy for China to essentially use surprise as a weapon. And if you hear the interviews which were given by India's General Officer Commanding in Chief, Lieutenant General YK Joshi, to Nitin Gokhale on Strat News Global and on a couple of other media forums, he also said very clearly that India and China came very close to a war in August when India did that maneuvering flank. So as such, I think China is now trying to manage the media. It could also be that they want to show that they retreated without any fuss and then basically take the moral high ground of springing a surprise elsewhere. So while it's encouraging in the sense that at least there is one less worry for now for the Indian Army and Ladakh being a very hostile territory. But at the same time, this may come back to bite us elsewhere in Arunachal or Uttarakhand or in the Sikkim sectors. So, but yeah, I think as of now, just in a very limited tactical sense, it seems like India has managed to push back on China, which has been a very, which is a rare event.
Right. So last week, it was announced that the Indian Metro Rail Project Engineer, E. Sridharan, will join the BJP in Kerala. Mr. Sridharan, more commonly known as the Metro Man, will formally join the BJP during the party's Vijay Yatra. He will reportedly contest the upcoming assembly elections in April-May. He's a recipient of the Padma Shri and the Padma Vibhushan for his contribution to the expansion of India's urban infrastructure. His induction into the party comes as a part of BJP's strategy to engage opinion makers such as former government servants, retired police officers, actors, and more. What do you make of this?
So I think it's a great development. The Modi government has never been shy of inducting technocrats at the highest level. And if you look at the cabinet, you have the likes of S. Jaishankar, Hardeep Puri. Earlier, you had, Manohar Parikar, and so on. So it has never shied away from taking on experts and putting them in portfolios where their expertise can be used. If you look at Kerala as a state, there really haven't been a lot of major infrastructure projects there for a very long time. You had Kochi Metro, which was again done by, sort of managed by Mr. Sridharan. So bringing him in is a clear indication that, there is room at the highest level. So there is talk of him being the chief ministerial candidate. Now it's up in the air whether BJP will do well enough in the elections to form the government or not. But the fact that he's being looked at as someone who can take the highest position in the state despite not having a political background and is purely a technocrat who is an expert and has built infrastructure and railway lines and projects across the country. And we are talking of some of the most challenging projects that, probably the world has seen, especially the Konkan Railway, for instance, right? He also was responsible for bringing up the first metro rail line in the country, which was in Kolkata in the 70s. I think there is, and you should also consider the fact that there are lots of rail and metro projects going on throughout the country right now. So even if BJP doesn't form the government, his expertise and his knowledge of bringing up and bringing to life all these infrastructure projects with very, very tight timelines will come in handy for the BJP as they're looking to build infrastructure across the country.
All right. The Union Cabinet has approved a PLI scheme for the telecom sector, and it's worth over 12,000 crore rupees. The telecom minister, Sri Ravi Shankar Prasad, expects the scheme to enhance production of more than 2.4 lakh crores of telecom equipment, along with exports worth 1.9 lakh crores. The goal of the PLI is to offset the huge import of telecom equipment worth more than 50,000 crores while reinforcing the Make in India initiative. With the announcement of this PLI, the total number of sectors under such programs stands at 13. Ashish, you've spoken about the PLI before. How will this particularly impact the telecom sector?
Yeah, looks like I've been talking about PLIs now nonstop since December of last year when we first did a detailed discussion in one of the weeklies and we covered it in the year-end episode also. So, but just to recap, PLI stands for Production Linked Incentives. What the government is saying is that for 13 sectors, they will provide incentives for some companies, some large companies to set up manufacturing or set up or expand manufacturing base in India. And for a limited period of X number of years, which would be 3 or 5 years, they would give back a percentage of the incremental sales back to these companies, to the chosen companies. Now, why are they refunding incremental sales and not, let's say, value added or profits or any other measure or investments or like capital expenditure? That's because sales is easier to track. It's all now via GST network. So the whole invoicing is very, the whole sales tracking is quite easy, basically. And if you go into the elements like profits or value added, some of it could also have financial engineering built into it. So sales is essentially the most raw metric, and that's why government decided to give back a percentage of sales directly to these approved manufacturers. Also, the government is actually doing some bit of a selection here in the sense that not everyone will be able to use the PLIs. The budgets are limited for each sector. So there'll be some level of selection. So government is banking on the winners here, backing the big firms who are able to create scale fast. So that is the background of what this entails. Now, telecom is interesting, Gary. As you said, 50,000 crores of imports. It's largely from China. So there's not just the volume, but also the fact that there's a strategic angle here in terms of the location itself. As India prepares to get into the 5G territory, you don't obviously want a lot of Chinese dependence. So this PLI program comes at a fairly good time where the 5G auctions, etc., or whenever the launch, whenever they happen in the next, let's say, 18 months, 24 months, that will also be backed by the gear which will be Indian in nature. Of course, it's not going to be 100% replacement. There'll still be foreign vendors involved. But a large part of that, even for the foreign vendors, can potentially be made out of India. And if you look at what has been approved in the PLI, that clearly points to that in that direction, right? So the scheme actually includes routers, IoT devices, which will be a key part of connecting connectivity in the 5G world, and radio access networks for both 4G and 5G, plus also wireless equipment. So the sign is very clear. The government is saying that at least the key components or the key parts of the 5G network deployment should happen with Indian gear or made in India gear, even if it's not Indian firms. Like you said, there are 13 industries to cover. So I suppose in the coming weeks we will talk about even more industries. We have had 4 or 5 mm-hmm. announcements so far, and periodically the government will keep adding. This has already been put in the budget, so pretty much it's on. So every week or every few days, we should actually hear more about the new PLI programs. One part which is interesting is that the next one on the card seems to be in the laptop and in the retail consumer electronics type space, which would be quite interesting again, because the mobile phones PLI has succeeded. We have attracted a lot of manufacturing to India through that route. Even without PLI, several factories had moved to India, but now with PLI, even the Taiwanese biggies have started coming to India, mainly in Chennai and also in Karnataka. So once the laptop one comes to India, that would probably complete the entire gamut of the whole telecom / consumer electronics portfolio. And hopefully that succeeds in over 5 years. our import dependency reduces significantly in these sectors.
Right. So we have a few interesting comments on YouTube, and I thought we'll quickly respond to them. Mandar Karnik says, one day this podcast will have a lot more subscribers and they will miss the 16 people watching them on a Sunday. Well, Mandar, we really, really appreciate you watching, you and the 15 others who are watching the, perhaps more who are watching the stream, live stream on a Sunday morning. Thank you so much. Really appreciate the love and support, right? Likewise, to Hemang Palan and the others who are watching. Thank you so much. All right, moving on. Odisha Chief Minister Sri Naveen Patnaik laid the foundation stone for India's largest hockey stadium last week. The stadium at Rourkela will be named after the freedom fighter Birsa Munda. It will host the Hockey World Cup in 2023, along with the Kalinga Stadium in Bhubaneswar. It will be constructed as a model of green, functional, cost-effective design. It will have a chaired seated capacity exceeding 20,000. Wow, that's a lot of details. What's are your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, if you look at Odisha as a state and Naveen Patnaik as a chief minister, he has constantly batted for non-cricket sports, sporting events and infrastructure to be set up in the state. So if you recall, the 2018 World Cup, Hockey World Cup was also held in Odisha. And this is a new stadium that is being built. And India actually lacks a lot of good AstroTurf hockey infrastructure, even though hockey is our national sport. Just to add on to some of the stuff being done by Odisha, because I think that's the key thing here. The state has continuously held some of the major, football tournaments in India, be it the Federation Cup or the Super Cup. In fact, one of the ISL teams also moved from Delhi to Odisha simply because they had to pay, a ridiculous amount as rent for being in the national capital. This state and Odisha also, has produced some of India's finest hockey players, like Dilip Turki, for instance. And it has continuously, it has won the award for being the number one state for promoting sport for 2 years in a row. So there is clearly something, that is part of a long-term plan in Odisha, where they want to be known as, the sporting capital of India. They already have a couple of cricket stadiums, but if you look at the other major sports in India, be it football or hockey, there is no other state, I think, which has as much infrastructure in one state and continuously holds tournaments and events at the highest level, be it, the World Cup. So even some games of the women's under 17 football World Cup will be held in Odisha. And then you have this Hockey World Cup. You have a strong football team based out of Odisha. So it just shows that the state has like a clear plan in terms of what it wants to do and is putting money where it matters and building infrastructure to encourage sports in the state and to set up sports infrastructure in the city, in the state.
Right. Fantastic. The Congress recorded a landslide win in the Punjab civic body elections. Amidst support for the farmers protesting against the farm laws, Congress won 1128 of the 1815 wards in municipal councils. They also won 271 of 350 municipal corporation seats. The win is a big boost for Chief Minister Amrinder Singh, who claimed that the farm laws are quote-unquote anti-people actions, which, again, within quotes, trampled the rights of farmers. He even added the Akali Dal and AAP's, a lot of quotes in this, crocodile tears hadn't fooled voters. Ashish, it's sort of a change, right, to talk about the Congress winning an election.
Yeah, quite expected, though, in the light of the farmer protests, which was going on. Congress won 7 out of the 8 municipal corporations which went to polls, including Hoshiarpur, Kapurthala, Pathankot, Batala, Bathinda, and Abohar. and Mohali, which the result of which came out a day later. And Moga, which was the eighth one, there also Congress had a lead, but they did not win it clearly, but they should be able to form their own council there. But Bathinda, which is a stronghold for SAT, that was won by Congress after 53 years. They will have a mayor after 53 years. And even the BJP strongholds like Pathankot and Hoshiarpur, again, Congress did very well. If you look at the municipal corporations, and BJP stood third narrowly behind SAD, about 11% votes. And if you look at the council results together, then of course BJP stood fourth, where AAP also was ahead of BJP. But anyway, I mean, AAP, SAD and BJP were practically routed. The differences are quite narrow. I think what has happened is the SAD-BJP split has hurt both the parties, at least in the short run, in the immediate run. SAD is now fighting for the same votes that AAP fights for, which is the rural Sikh vote. And that really hasn't, materialized for them. And the BJP, of course, wouldn't probably have got any Sikh vote at all, given how the farmer protests have panned out. So the Punjab elections are to be held next year. And clearly, Congress will be buoyed by this result, at least in the context of Punjab. And of course, nationally, commentators have already talked about how this is a resurgence of Congress and this is a big challenge for the Modi government, which is, of course, a little bit of exaggeration, to put it mildly. In fact, even last time, SAD had done quite well in these polls, in the municipal polls, but they were routed in the state polls, which happened a year later in 2017. So as such, while Captain Amrinder Singh has called them a semi-final for the next year, it doesn't really mean much how the winds will blow. But of course, Congress will be a front runner definitely and a favorite to win the 2022 polls. What is interesting is that if BJP can BJP go ahead on its own from 11% to say 20-25% in the state polls? That is the question which faces the BJP. Otherwise, I think it also strengthens Captain Amrinder's position in the Congress party. He has been one leader who has consistently won on his own name and on his own image, which started with if you go back to the Lok Sabha polls of 2014, there he had defeated Arun Jaitley in Amritsar. Then 2017, he won the state polls. 2019, Lok Sabha again, Congress did well. And now the local polls. So he has a big stature, of course, in the party. May not mean much, again, from party's own internal politics, the way it runs. But yes, I mean, finally, some kind of a positive news for Congress as far as elections are concerned.
All right, moving on. Chinese money seems to be exiting the Indian startup ecosystem. Last week, CreditBee held a fundraising round, cutting down their Chinese funding in the company from 40% to 10% after raising about 544 crore rupees. Tata also announced a $1.3 billion acquisition of Big Basket. This will fetch them a 68% stake in the company. Reportedly, they are planning to take the company public next year. This is pretty important development, right? I mean, after apps bans, we're also seeing Chinese investors becoming, not really welcome in India after this. What do you make of this?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's what I was going to come to, which is that, when we spoke about the app ban in August and September, I think we had said that this is just the start and the next step would be that we'll see Chinese money move out of India. And that was the question that was asked by the skeptics then. Oh, you banned the apps, but what about Chinese investment? So I think this is a trend that has just started. It will continue and only get stronger. Because if you look at the two things to look at here, right? One is the Indian startup ecosystem and the other thing is the Indian VC or funding ecosystem. And both have changed dramatically in the last few years. Startups start not just with ideas, but they start with minimal viable products. There are more entities who are interested in putting money in India, foreign venture capital funds and PE funds and so on. The other thing that has happened, and I'm seeing it accelerate, is the growth of the angel funding network in India. And a sort of a group of people coming together, putting, you know, small amounts in a startup, right? And there are events organized regularly. There are organizations that enable, you know, even retail investors to put in small and relatively small amounts into startups, right? So they can also benefit from this rapid growth that we are seeing in the tech sector in India. Obviously, this has been helped by, you know, the growth of 4G, the Jio factor, and so on, which we've talked a lot about. It is just a matter of time, I think, by when we will see Chinese money move more or less out of India. We are moving them out, you know, in a phased manner, starting with apps. Then, as Ashish mentioned, on the 5G side, we do not expect to see them play a major role. And this is going to be the last stage, probably, where at least in the tech sector, we will see them move out. We've also spoken about replacing some of these less value-added Chinese imports with Atmanirbhar stuff that's made in India. So it's a process. It's not going to happen overnight, but it's something that has definitely accelerated in the last few months, and it's something that will go on for the next few years. It's kind of deleveraging for India, as far as China is concerned.
Absolutely. So, you know, with interest rates as low across the world, India is going to be like a super lucrative investment destination for sure, right? And you're going to find, as a result, more of this growth stage capital finding its way to India, which is really, really amazing, because there's plenty of early stage action, as you touched upon. You know, people are writing those angel checks and whatnot. And even the likes of Sequoia and Axel, right, which are the larger institutional VCs, are writing the $1 to $5 million checks. So a lot of early stage innovation is being encouraged, but then you need the 40, 50, 100 million check sizes to kind of catalyze this early stage innovation into developing, like, let's say, Indian unicorns and stuff, right? Because you need that kind of money for growth and expansion, right? Whether it is within India, within the sector, or even outside of India, right? As in the case of SaaS companies and so on. So overall, I think it's a fantastic development, and we should all be keenly watching this in a sense.
And, right. Shout out to the founders of Ku, because they've had some Chinese investment, and they've come out and said that they're proactively looking to bring it down to zero and looking to buy out the Chinese investment. So, hats off to them for doing it proactively.
Absolutely. All right. We had plenty of love and support from all of you last week. Really, thank you again for all of this. It keeps us motivated to do whatever we're doing. Ashish, you want to pick up on anything in particular?
Yeah, I would like to talk about the Conservative Friends of the Commonwealth. This is an organization which we recently came across via some of the podcasts which we put out. And we've been in touch with this organization. It sounds very interesting that they have got a network of conservative-leaning individuals in UK who engage with the with the politicians in UK, setting agenda, talking to them about priorities of right-leaning folks on, not just in UK, but from the diaspora side as well, right? And when I say diaspora, it's not just Indian diaspora. I mean, they cover, as the name suggests, all Commonwealth countries. And they try and explain the issues which may be happening in countries like Australia or New Zealand or India, Pakistan, Jamaica, to the UK politicians. And we found this quite interesting, and we've had a few conversations in terms of how they can benefit from Bharat Varta content, and how we can engage them better, their audience better. So I think the platforms allow you luxury to create networks of like-minded individuals, need not be restricted to, I mean, what you thought would be a very India-centric topic may actually have a big resonance or big importance for people in UK to understand, and especially as the more bilateral alliances pick up, like India-UK trade deal will definitely happen sometime this year and potentially in the next couple of months. So I'm sure UK politicians would want to know more about let's say the farmer protests from the perspective of the other side. I mean, in the sense that they probably have heard enough given the preponderance of the Punjabi community in UK. I'm sure they've had one point of view. They may want to hear another point of view, right? So I think discussions like these are quite interesting and also show how the barriers have diminished between countries in terms of exchange of thoughts and ideas. Also, how disinformation can spread if people don't collaborate well enough, right? So we kind of spoke about that on the episode with Vishal and Richel. But I think individuals and organizations like the CFOC can play a big part in bringing together wide perspectives and different perspectives.
Yeah. No, absolutely. I think that has been the interesting part to me when I look at a lot of the comments, right? I mean, these are like typically from diaspora saying that, typically we get information from one source or one particular persuasion. I mean, it's good to see the other side and it's good to see a wider perspective in that sense, like a diversity of opinions and so on. Vatsa, anything from your end, any pick?
I think Swati's comment is very interesting. In the sense that it's good that people, have an intuitive understanding of what's going on in India, even though they may not be in India. And what we are doing is bringing up episodes and content, which helps them validate their opinion with facts, with real facts. So I think that's a very good comment that I like.
All right, that's it from us. Thank you so much for choosing myself. Until next time, stay safe, take care, and Jai Hind.